I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a political topic, a topic in politics that has been an important issue since the founding of the Republic, really, all the way up until today. It continues to be important. It continues to be controversial. And that is the issue of legislative redistricting. And we're going to be talking about it today with Dan Tierney. Dan Tierney is the press secretary for the governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine. Mr. Tierney also happens to be an Ashbrook Scholar alum, having graduated, I won't say the year, having graduated a few years ago now, Dan.
Thank
But he had gone on to have a distinguished career in public life, not only serving the governor, but of course serving in the attorney general's office, and then, of course, for other public officials in the state of Ohio. So Dan is a person who's been around the public life of Ohio and has had to think about and talk about complicated, difficult issues like redistricting for pretty much his whole career. So we're delighted to have him with us today for this conversation. Dan, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Redistricting or districting. For congressional seats and for state house seats and apportionment. Under our constitutional system, I think some people don't even start from an understanding of, under our constitutional system, what is the role of the states in determining districts for the United States House of Representatives and then for their own state legislatures? Because that has been in the news over and over and over again, and it will be again in the news this election year, 2024.
And I know that that is something that, as an undergraduate at Ashland, we talked about powers reserved to the federal government, powers reserved to the states, and redistricting is a good example where the Constitution and our founding fathers, they kind of set up a framework, but left the decisions on how to draw legislative districts, in this case, the federal legislative districts, to the states. So I think they had good foresight in figuring out that if you're creating two houses in the legislature, they had one where every state was going to be represented the same in the Senate with two seats. And then we were going to have a house that was going to be appointed by population. Of course, when our country was founded, Virginia was the most populous state. That has ceased to be. It's now California, although Texas looks like it may be giving it a run for its money in the next decade or two. But they figured out that the seats were going to change over time. The population was going to change over time. And so they decided every 10 years, we're going to conduct a census in this country. That's a federal The federal government does the United States Census. We have a United States Census Bureau that conducts that. And then they put out a apportionment figure that says, okay, this is how many congressional seats each state gets. And sometimes it comes down to 100 votes. I remember, I can't remember if it was this legislative cycle or last legislative cycle, Minnesota was determined to have just 100 more voters in the state of New York. So they got to keep a congressional seat. New York had to lose an extra congressional seat as a result of that. So, but they do it every 10 years and it's done in the year ending zero. So 20, next one will be in 2030. And we're going to perhaps see that a little bit early in Ohio, which we'll get to in a minute. But every 10 years, it has to be done pursuant to the Constitution. The states get to determine how they do it. In Ohio, we had a constitutional amendment that was passed last decade, around 2017, by the voters of Ohio. It was actually modeled after an amendment that was passed for state legislative seats in 2015 to do things a certain way. And so We do it in Ohio based upon a redistricting commission currently, and the legislature has a role in congressional seats. The redistricting commission has complete control over the state legislative seats. But Ohio, last few cycles, has lost a seat. It's not that we've shrunken population, but our population in Ohio here has not grown as fast as other parts of the country. So we've gone down from, you know, more than 20 congressional seats in the middle part of the last century to just 15 now. You know, the current delegation is made up of 10 Republicans and 5 Democrats. But of course, that could change based upon the outcomes of this upcoming election. So very important thing to do, because obviously these districts have to have similar populations. You want to keep communities of interest together. Obviously, we have congressional districts that are based in, you know, Cleveland and Cincinnati and Columbus. And then you've got others that, okay, that's kind of the rural Northwest Ohio seat. You've kind of got an Appalachian seat here or there. So again, the folks try to keep communities of interest together with that as well.
Obviously, as you talked about the redistricting commission, your boss, the governor, has a position on that commission. And the work of the commission in the state of Ohio, and I think this is true broadly around the country, redistricting, or every 10 years, as you say, based on the census, always brings intense partisan controversy. What has the controversy been in the state of Ohio?
So, as I mentioned, we went from a system that prior to the 2017 amendment in Ohio, and every state does it differently. I mean, you've got states like California that has an independent redistricting commission. They establish theirs to address incumbent protection gerrymandering. The people behind it thought that they could get political advantage by having the district stop protecting incumbents and just kind of match the state. You've got others. States that completely do it through the legislature, which is the way Ohio did it. Some of the other states that were accused of having brutal gerrymanders, like Maryland and Illinois, they did theirs completely through the legislature. Some, because there's such a dispute, or, you know, they have maps that are dictated by courts had to have been redone by courts. New York, I think, recently redid their congressional maps pursuant to that, and there are others. There's also other states where, pursuant to the Civil Rights Act, Ohio is not a state that's subject to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but if you have a significant enough population in a state that's historically disadvantaged minorities, you're subject to a particularly higher scrutiny federal review for your districts. So lots of different systems that the Constitution has allowed the states to choose how they do it. Courts are certainly involved. In Ohio, again, we chose a system in 2017, kind of mirrored after the legislative process that was done in a bipartisan manner. Democrats, Republicans got together and passed a new system ostensibly to reduce gerrymandering in the state of Ohio. For those who don't know where the term comes from, gerrymandering was named after a newspaper cartoon in Massachusetts in the early 1800s after Eldridge Gerry there. A person behind a particular map had these odd-looking districts in the state of Massachusetts, so they likened it to a salamander, hence we got the term the portmanteau gerrymander. And the idea behind that, of course, was that they weren't drawing naturally aligned districts, they were just trying to get as much political advantage for a particular party as possible. In Ohio, what we did with both the state legislative amendment and the congressional amendment was they wanted to limit the times you could split a city. Like if you look at Massachusetts map, for example, or the Illinois map, you have a lot of districts stemming from Boston and Chicago that got a sliver of the city and then branch out into the suburbs and sometimes even rural areas. To try and get as many districts where the population base in Boston or Chicago or whatever city you're talking about is then determining who's going to be the representative there. So in Ohio, what they wanted to do is reduce the times a city was split, the times a county was split. If you could keep counties whole, do it. If you could keep cities whole, do it. The other thing that was interesting in Ohio, and this doesn't exist anywhere else in the country, Jeff, is they put into a state constitution the idea that we want your congressional seats and your state representative seats, state Senate seats, to be proportional to how the statewide vote has gone for partisan candidates over the past decade. This is a what they call the Fair Maps concept, named after these groups like Fair Maps Ohio and other groups that have put forward this contest. So, for example, you know, the governor in his reelection in 22 won with about 2/3 of the vote in his reelection. That's kind of how the congressional races fell out there. So that kind of hit the goal of that amendment, where 2/3 of the seat went Republican, just as 2/3 of the vote went for Republican Mike DeWine. But that's kind of where the controversy happened leading up to that election, in that the previous decade, which goes all the way back to, you know, 2010, 2012 elections, you know, those are times when Barack Obama won the state of Ohio, Democrat Sherrod Brown won the state of Ohio. You had some other races that were a lot closer than the 22 election. The percentage statewide was closer to 57-43, which is a good 6-point difference than what 10-point difference, depending how you look at it, than what we were talking about in 2022. And so that was the proportion that a lot of people were trying to shoot for. And there was a lot of difficulty in drawing those maps. And I had a front row seat to it, as you mentioned, being the governor's press secretary and watching these hearings. There was just a lot of difficulty trying to get those maps to hit that proportion. And again, with Ohio being the only state in the country that has this proportional representation requirement. We had some outside experts at one point coming to draw the maps, and they said this is the only thing they've ever seen anywhere like it in the country.
Can I pause for just one moment then?
Because
if I'm understanding this correctly, because this is such a unique situation in Ohio, although obviously it has echoes in other states and is connected, mm-hmm. You're saying that in Ohio, if 60% of the statewide vote, for example, went to Governor DeWine, 60% of the congressional seats, Governor DeWine being a Republican, or if the presidential candidate for the Republicans, Donald Trump, won, you know, 55% of the vote in Ohio, that percentage of congressional seats should be drawn in such a way as to yield 55% Republican seats in the congressional delegation and in the General Assembly, the House, and the Senate.
That's right. If you look at what they did is they took the previous 10 years, which include, you know, Barack Obama's reelection, Donald Trump's election, Joe Biden's election. They took all the governor's races with Mike DeWine and John Kasich, the Secretary of State's races with John Husted and Frank LaRose. You just go on down the line. And then every race that had a partisan statewide total to it, they averaged it together. And that's how they came up with that 43 percentage, which of course in our Ohio House we have 99 seats, so it's a little bit different, but pretty close. The state Senate has 33 seats, and then we've got a congressional delegation of 15. So, you know, for our national listeners who are listening, who are most concerned about Congress, that'd be about an 8-7 ratio in the congressional races.
And yet, as you mentioned, Ohio has a delegation that is 10 Republican, 5 Democrat, not 8-7.
Correct.
Is that controversy?
Well, one of the controversies there, as I mentioned, you know, when you do a 10-year look back, what we've seen in Ohio is a great shift in where things are going. Let me give you a few examples. So in 2012, Sandusky, Ohio area, the state Democratic Party chairman represented them in the state house. I believe he was defeated in 2014, and that seat has been held Republican ever since. But that's an area of the state where they had been giving votes to Democrats in the early part of that percentage, the early part of that 10-year look back, a lot more than they were at the latter end. The Mahoning Valley, where I grew up in, I'm a Trumbull County native. Those Trumbull and Mahoning County started giving their votes to Republicans during the Donald Trump era a lot more than during the Barack Obama era. We don't know if that'll be a permanent trend or not, so we'll look at this every time we have to do maps. But so what you ended up with is those 2012, 2014 elections, the Democrats were doing a lot better and were kind of able to run up their score. The problem we had is that when we were then trying to draw the districts, you had to use the most recent partisan data. So the Democrats were getting credit for votes they had run up the score on during the Barack Obama years, but then during the Trump and Biden years, those voters were voting Republican. And it was very difficult as well, because you also had the anti-redistricting, we also had the anti-gerrymandering rules. So let's take, for example, East Cleveland up in Cuyahoga County. It's one of the most Democratic cities in the state. You can't split that up into three or four districts to try and, put more Democrats into extra districts. So we ended up with a situation where, as many of our listeners know, there are more Democratic votes in urban areas, and they're very highly concentrated. And because you could not split the cities and counties that they were in more than necessary, you couldn't spread those votes out amongst more districts.
So you really have a fundamental problem. You have forces pulling different directions. If you're trying to say, why can't we just get these legislative maps right? Whatever people mean by that question, but they often say that, right?
Right.
And you're saying, like, the state of Ohio, on the one hand, you have the Constitution and the process saying, well, it needs to be roughly proportionate politically. On the other hand, it's saying, yeah, but you can't split cities up, or you shouldn't try to split up counties in order to do that. And you just can't do those two things together.
Right. And so this got litigated extensively. And when you hit like the second or third lawsuit, especially in the legislative maps, there came about a concept the Ohio Supreme Court created called political asymmetry. That was the term they used in the court cases. And the idea behind that was that eventually they got the maps that were passed by the majority of the redistricting commission, and the redistricting commission had 7 members. It was a 5-2 Republican majority. The way it's comprised is you have the governor, the secretary of state, and the state auditor, plus the a designee of each political party in the state house and the state senate. So that's the 7 members. The 2 Democrats were from the legislative side. You had the three statewide office holders who were Republican, and then the 2 Republican caucus representatives. So after the first map was dismissed by the court as being, they felt that it was unconstitutional because it didn't match the proportion, they got pretty close to the proportion in the second map. But what happened, and you would completely expect this, was that when they got that proportion down, there were a lot of heavily Republican districts and a lot more marginal Democrat districts. And that's just pure geometry and math right there. So easiest way to think about this is, and of course, in the DeWine world, Mike DeWine and Fran DeWine are often associated with pies and with their ice cream social and, Fran's love of baking and her cookbooks. So if you ever make a homemade pie with homemade pie dough, your pie dough kind of starts out in a ball. And that ball takes up the least amount of surface area when it's in a ball form, but it's also at its thickest. When you roll it out and do a 12-inch circle, it gets flatter, but it gets thinner. And the same thing applies with legislative districts. If you take the same amount of Republican voters and you put them into as few districts as possible, you're going to end up with the smallest amount of area, but the same amount of votes, it's going to get thicker. And with the Democratic districts, again, they tried to create as many as possible. So they were spreading those votes out amongst multiple districts, and the margins got thinner. And so that would be completely expected based upon what they asked the court to do. But the court said, well, it's unconstitutional to have all your Republican districts be thick and all your Democratic districts be thin. Although doing what the court case told you to do, that would be completely expected, because they're telling you, put all your Republicans into this number of districts, which is smaller than they were at, and create more Democratic districts than you had, and you had to do it with the same number of votes. And it's not like we could annex the West Virginia Panhandle or Southern Michigan to add votes to
or just force people from Republican to Democratic voters.
Yeah, so you had a finite number of voters, but they were asking you to manipulate the districts, and when you did that, you the numbers went exactly where you thought they were. So we ended up at an impasse for multiple rounds, and eventually some citizens sued and said, well, if we don't decide on districts, federal court, you need to help us out, because we'll be disenfranchised unless you set the districts so we can go forward and vote in the next election, which is what happened. Then we had the results of the next election and a court order to do new districts. Well, that's where that 10-year look back comes into play again. So you not only had a 10-year look back, but the 2012 elections, which included Barack Obama's reelection and Sherrod Brown's reelection, that went out of the formula because it was no longer the 10-year look-back window. What then happened was that you had Mike DeWine's very large reelection, a very successful Republican statewide election for all the statewide candidates, and for the first time, Ohio elected Supreme Court justices with partisan labels. So those races were now thrown in the formula for the first time, whereas before they'd been nonpartisan. So what that did is it increased the proportion by about 2 or 3 percentage points and allowed some of the previous map concepts that the court said were unconstitutional. The Democrats, Republicans got together on the redistricting commission and said, look, we've got a larger margin now. We probably have a window we can come to a political agreement with. And they did. The Democrats, the Republicans came together on the redistricting commission, came up with a political compromise that is now going to be in place through the end of the decade, barring new constitutional amendment, which is being considered.
Coming out of this conversation, again, I think our listeners will say, Dan, this is incredibly complex, this issue of redistricting. You're in the middle of this as Governor DeWine's press secretary. You've talked about some of the conversations that you've had with news media and reporters over the course of this controversy. Can you take a step back and talk a little more broadly about your role as press secretary, in particular, your relationship with the press? Governor DeWine obviously was reelected by, as you say, 2/3 of the vote, a gigantic majority for any statewide office. He's obviously been a fairly popular governor, getting a lot of votes. But nevertheless, the press is always the press. It's designed to be critical. It's supposed to be critical. And therefore, they're going to ask you critical questions about the governor, his actions, and his record. How do you handle the press?
One of the principles that I've adopted, and partially because it's what the governor expects, is that the press is an important part of politics. I mean, sometimes they're called the fourth rail or the fourth branch of government. But they do have a role in helping inform the public. In media, we have the concept of paid media, which is, buying ads. And certainly in Ohio with our primary next week, we're seeing a lot of ads on TV, but that's paid media. And then there's the idea of earned media, which is trying to get coverage for things that are newsworthy. And the governor wants us to be open and transparent about what we're doing in state government. He wants the public to be able to know what state government is doing, even if he disagrees with a particular issue. A good example of that is the American Rescue Plan. Governor opposed that. He wasn't in Congress at the time, but they asked him as governor, do you support ARPA or do you oppose ARPA? And he's like, I think this is too much money being spent. But once it was passed and money had to be spent by the state of Ohio or else it would go to California or New York, governor said, we'll make sure that this is spent properly, and we put out a press release and talk to media every time we spend money from ARPA, so the public has a track record. They have a way of knowing how that was spent, and they can write us or email us or call us if they disagree with that or not. And we've tried to spend it on one-time things that are important to people. Like, we have a lot of areas of Ohio that were on septic systems that could have built sewers, and now they had money to do that for the first time. One-time money on one-time expenses, he thinks, is a very conservative way to deal with that particular situation. So we try to be as transparent as we can. I mean, sometimes the answer is we can't comment on that because it involves a litigation or a prosecution that's not appropriate for us to comment on in deference to that branch of government. Sometimes, the issues are not ripe. A bill will get introduced in the legislature, and it has the possibility of getting amended several times before it even come to the governor's desk. And so sometimes we'll say that that bill is not something we'll comment on until it comes to the governor's desk. Other times, because the governor is the one who wants it introduced and wants it, the governor wants it introduced or he wants it passed, he'll have a press conference and say, I support this bill, and we'll let people know on the front end of that. But we try with the news media to let people know as much as possible and try to give the news media content because, they've got a lot of time to fill. And we think we're doing a public service by trying to get as much of what's going on in state government into the 4 or 5, 6 o'clock newscast or the website of a newspaper, which is, I think, how people read those these days, especially in Columbus, where our local newspaper, the print edition, is sometimes 2 days old, whereas the internet website is as accurate as possible. So that's our philosophy, is let's be transparent. Let's try to put this information out there. We'll meet the media where they are. Governor does a lot of gaggles, probably some of the most of any governor in Ohio history. And certainly during COVID, that was a unique time as well. We were doing daily press conferences to let people know what was going on with COVID, what was opening up, what the strategy was behind things, where the numbers were, how people could make the best decisions for themselves. And so there was a good period for more than 100 days where we were doing press conferences every single day, even on weekends.
Now, notwithstanding that fact that governor does a lot of press gaggles, meaning he has meets with groups of reporters, and you say the governor's philosophy is to get information out to the public through the press, every politician complains, sometimes privately, sometimes publicly, about unfair press coverage. Has the governor had fair press coverage?
I think it certainly is upon me and my team here at the governor's office to try and make sure the press has enough information to make sure that they can cover him fairly. You know, sometimes there's just two sides to an issue, and the press may choose to cover the other side. And the governor was like, well, why did they write that? And I had to explain that why they may have written it that way, where their perspective was. But part of the way to combat that is just to make sure that they have the facts so that we are operating from the same set of facts. Because there could be situations where we're not operating from the same set of facts. There's times where reporters call us and say, hey, I've heard this, is it true? And the answer is no, it's it's not true. So we have to get them on the same set of facts. And there's so many different issues. The pandemic was a big one where I will give a newspaper in Northeast Ohio, I won't name them credit, but they came in and thinking that the governor's policy was one thing and we provided them data. And they wrote that, nope, the governor's not doing what we thought they would in a bad way. He's actually doing what he said he was doing in a good way. And so, and certainly when you get to state politics and state coverage, there's a lot less trying to fill a evening primetime talk show lineup, whatever your political perspective is on things. And the role of a daily state house reporter or a regional reporter for your chain newspaper in your hometown is a lot different than people who are working for Fox News or CNN or MSNBC or the three legacy broadcast networks, 630 News. So we do have a lot better opportunity to try and get our story across. But certainly there are times where we're frustrated that they decided not to take our perspective on things. But our job as a communication staff is to try to get them the information so that at the very least, they're not operating from a different set of facts from where we're coming from.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
Well, let me ask you something then about, because that suggests that, of course, in the end, what the press decides to publish is what the press decides to publish, whether that's newspapers, whether that's online, radio, TV. The governor and government obviously has no control over that. I mean, we know James Madison said, I think, for example, the free press is the palladium of liberty, even though that does cause annoyance to some sometimes. Talk a little bit about your opinion, if you can, about the state of the press and of freedom of the press.
So we're seeing a few different things happen in terms of where media coverage is. Things are a lot different than when I was a kid and you had three broadcast news networks and not everybody had cable, so they didn't have access to CNN, and the newspapers were heavily purchased to get daily news content. And so that changed the way things have changed from those days to where we have social media telling us how our representatives have voted on a daily basis. In fact, sometimes we are so in tune with how they're voting, we know how they're voting on procedural votes in Congress in a way that we probably never did before. If I'm thinking back to when I was a kid, your Sunday paper probably had a summary near the op-ed pages that said, okay, here's how your congressional representatives voted this week. And unless the bill that was being discussed was so big that it warranted its own national news article, you had no idea how your congressman was voting on a procedural vote to advance a budget bill. Today, we have so much media and so much information out there, we know that. I'm sure you've seen tweets where somebody's disappointed in so-and-so or happy with so-and-so because they voted a certain way just on a procedural vote to block a budget bill or advance a nomination. So we have that level of information now, and that's certainly played into the way that politics is practiced around this country because people are interested in that and people expect things the way we do from voters in a way that wasn't the same 20 years ago. And so that certainly, I think, influences our party primaries because we have a higher level of accountability due to different media. So I think there is a difference between legacy media and social media getting the information out there. So with the advent of cable news and cable news channels, you know, again, 8 to 11 every night, you've got talk shows that are bringing guests on from Congress, from the administration, from around the states. Governor DeWine's appeared on a number of them. He did as Attorney General. I know our current Attorney General, Dave Yost, the Lieutenant Governor, John Husted, they've all appeared on some of these programs to encourage the discourse. And so we have more discourse in a way that we didn't, 30, 20 years ago, because CNN existed, of course, in the late 70s, early 80s. We didn't have Fox News and MSNBC till the mid 90s. So these were tools that we didn't have that existed before. So certainly the way that we get our news in terms of immediacy, in terms of coming into our house and more players out there, it certainly changes those things. I think where people get frustration of, and I've certainly seen it, is one of the most difficult things is if you do not prepare for an interview and try to be difficult to both sides, that's where I think bias can come into play. So we don't see that as much with the Ohio State House News Corps, but if you go to a cable news channel and you see a anchor having a free-flowing conversation, you know, sometimes we'll be frustrated because we see that anchor, if they're ideologically in line with their guest, they'll probably have a free-flowing conversation, no pushback. But if the anchor or interviewer has a opinion or political philosophy opposite of what their guest is and they give their normal talking points, they, you know, cognitive dissonance kicks in, and immediately they say, hey, I know there's an opposite opinion. I know the other side's got this version, and they bring it up. And that's what we see most often is, you know, sometimes one party will get a easy interview. The other side will get a lot tougher interviews because they're just bringing up all these points that are coming up in their brains. Tim Russert, the late Tim Russert, I thought did a very good job. I remember my mother, we'd watch Meet the Press on Sunday mornings after church, and she would always be so impressed how Tim Russert would hold people's feet to the fire. I remember there was one episode she was just cheering because he had asked Al Gore, the Vice President of the United States, the same question 7 or 8 times in a row, and he wouldn't answer it, and he just kept asking it until he answered it. And his strategy, and Tim Russert used to work for this Democratic Senator of New York, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, but he decided, I'm just going to ask everybody tough questions. And you have to be super prepared to do that, have a plan in an interview. And he was very respected by both sides of the aisle. And I don't think too many people thought he was biased, even though he came from a partisan political background, just because he was prepared and asked tough questions to both sides. If you're just going in an interview, I think without that, that's where these allegations of bias come into play, because, you know, if you're talking to somebody of the same political background as you, these moments of cognitive dissonance don't come up and the interview goes smooth. And when you're talking with somebody who's got different opinions than you, cognitive dissonance comes into play and you're like, hey, there's this other point I should bring up as a journalist and ask the question. And that's fine. But if you don't do it to both sides, that's where people, I think, come into bias. And so,
well, that's so let me ask you this. So someone like Tim Russert trying to ask the hard question to get an answer. All right. Maybe this has never happened to Dan Tierney. What happens if a reporter asks Dan Tierney a tough question about the governor, his policies, his positions, his opinions, asks a tough question, and Dan Tierney is stumped?
Well, the short version is I'll have to get back to you. now, if somebody's on deadline and in immediate need of an answer, obviously that puts us in a bind. But one of the nice things of it being the governor's press secretary and not the White House press secretary, you know, because people probably, when they hear press secretary, they think, well, White House press secretary, Corinne Jean-Pierre or Kayleigh McEnany, just to pick ones from both sides. Their job includes having to go up every weekday in front of the White House press corps and answer questions for an hour every single day. Luckily, I don't have to do that as governor's press secretary. And I don't think any of the 50s governor's press secretaries have to do that. So I do have that advantage that the White House press secretary doesn't. So if they're calling, and as long as they're not calling or emailing or texting right before their deadline, I will be able to say and do the research and then get back to them. So we do have the opportunity to do that. And luckily we have a great team here in state government that could get us the answers quickly. And part of that is that we need to, these are important issues and we want to make sure that people get informed properly. And sometimes the answer, of course, is we haven't taken a position on that bill yet. Often when it's on a legislative bill, and that's where things may be most interesting, we do get a lot of questions there. We do have a legislative team in our office and they're talking with the legislators, and sometimes the bill that they're calling about is something I'm very familiar with because it's hot button and we've been briefed on it and we're involved in talking with the legislature about where the governor is and what would make him likely to sign the bill or not sign the bill or what we want in the bill. And other times it's this obscure bill I've never heard of until they've asked the question. And in deference to the reporter, I just need to find out what the facts are before I shoot from the hip, which we don't want to do. So, and the answer may be that we haven't taken a position on it yet, because again, that bill could change several times before it comes to the governor's desk.
Let me ask you this. What, you've had some time now as press secretary to engage with the press, to have that conversation, to represent the governor's opinion, and to give information, as you say, to the public through the press. What's, in your experience, what's the most important skill that a press secretary needs?
I think one of the reasons I've been able to...
What quality, what virtue, what ability is the most important?
One of the things, and I certainly think that my education at Ashland helped with this, is being able to take chunks of information, whether it's reading, whether it's a briefing, listening to information, and being able to digest it and explain it to people in a way they can understand it. I won't say the number because I don't want to insult anybody out there or impress anybody, but we certainly do try in written communications to, if you look at the readability score in a Microsoft Word document, for example, we want it to be readable in a way that most Ohioans would be able to understand it. That's certainly a level that's less than a law school level or a postgraduate degree level. And so part of my job is being able to explain it and maybe also come up with examples that people would understand why we're doing this or that we do it elsewhere. So my skills of knowing random useless trivia that's sometimes good at a restaurant trivia game come in handy as well, because I can keep a catalog of things of why we do things. A good example is some of our health related stuff. Sometimes there's a bill or a rule that goes into place where we're asking people to report things to the Department of Health. And people may not realize things are reported to the Department of Health. There was a incident many years ago, probably about 10 years ago, where there was a food poisoning incident at a church in Fairfield County. There was bad potato salad and a bunch of people got botulism. Fortunately, well, one of the parishioners died. But the reason they found that out was that law, both at the federal and state level, require people to report botulism to the state departments of health. And that way, if there's multiple cases, where they can link that together, do the research, figure out where that came from. Because in the case of, we've often heard, yep, romaine lettuce was pulled from the shelves again because of listeria. So they're going to have a shortage on Caesar salads, but nobody's getting sick. And the reason they know that is they can trace the cases, figure out what they all ate. If they had something in common, they can trace that, put it off the shelves, close the restaurant for a little bit, whatever it is. And so I've been able to use that example for reporters to say, why would the state ever need anything reported to the Department of Health? And I can use that example if there's a honest to goodness reason, and it's to keep people safe. We don't want anybody dying because they're eating unsafe food. And that's one of the ways we research it, is people reporting conditions to the Department of Health. Other cases are where we report things to the Department of Health. We put out a public report and people can make their own decisions on where things are going in the state. One example, that's abortion. We do an annual abortion report where we just report how many times it happens. Because the providers then report that to the state, and we then put out to the public how many times it happens, where it happens, how it's done. And then we don't make any opinions on it, but we just put the information out there for public policymakers to make their own decisions. And both sides, whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, use that information. And it's part of the philosophy. Again, if everybody's operating from the same set of information, you're going to have a lot better discourse because you're operating from the same set of facts. The governor often says that if we don't have the same set of facts, we're never going to come to an agreement. But if we're operating from the same set of facts, we have a better chance of having an outcome that's best for the people of the state of Ohio. And so that's one of the important reasons why we try to do political communications from our office, is just make sure everybody's got the same set of facts and we have a well-educated citizenry that can engage in public discourse in at a high level.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, a very appropriate way to end our conversation with the governor of the great state of Ohio, Governor Mike DeWine, his press secretary, Dan Tierney. Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thank you very much for having me, Jeff.
Dan, I mentioned earlier in our conversation the press, and particularly freedom of the press, the freedom of the press to ask hard questions, to be present with public officials, to phone calls, in-person gaggles with the governor and with yourself, as you were talking about. There was a particular incident that I think some people in Ohio and maybe even around the nation found particularly disturbing, of an incident where I think the governor was speaking to a group of the press in East Palestine, and a reporter was present reporting, and I believe was either detained or even arrested by local law enforcement. If my memory serves me correct, what was the governor's reaction to that incident?
Well, his initial reaction when he found out what happened was that I certainly would not have wanted handled that way. The facts were that there was a reporter from News Nation, which is a newer news channel. I think it's the remnants of the old WGN America. I could be wrong on that, but it's a Sinclair owned a company, and they are a national news outlet. I have it on my DirecTV subscription, but it may not be on everybody's cable system. But it's out there, and they're newer, and they had a reporter come to the scene, and he was doing a live shot in the middle of the governor's press conference. and a member of the Ohio National Guard asked him to quiet down. And the reporter didn't want to do that in the middle of his live shot, and things escalated, unfortunately, and the reporter was arrested. Now, eventually the charges were dropped. The governor urged that the charges be dropped. But that was certainly a situation where he had said, I would not have wanted it handled that way. But it came from a place where the press was trying to do their job. The governor acknowledged that the press was trying to do their job. The people involved were just trying to make sure that the other people in the front of the room, because of course this was in a gymnasium in East Palestine, Ohio, and anybody who's ever been in a gymnasium knows the sound does not operate the same way that they do in our offices or our homes. Lots of echoes. You could have sound in different parts of the room. So that's what they were trying to get, make sure the people in the front of the room had the same ability to hear the people, again, trying to relay important information about what was going on the ground in that situation. So governor certainly had said, I would have wanted it handled a different way. The reporter had every right to be in the back of that room, giving a live briefing, even though the governor was giving a briefing in the same room. So it was an unfortunate situation, but it certainly did bring up the issues that you said of, and certainly allowed people across the country to crystallize in their minds what they would do in that situation. For the governor and for our team, in retrospect, we would have wanted people to handle it a different way than it had been handled.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because then obviously it elicited a lot of outrage among the media itself. In a situation like that, you know, very rarely do reporters get arrested, certainly in a live broadcast. In a situation like that, where there's an incident like that, where there's a lot of media coverage and perhaps a lot of media outrage, in questions go immediately to the governor. And in a situation like that, do they go to you as the governor's press secretary first? Do they go to the governor first? Do you and the governor meet to discuss his views and what he wants articulated? How does that kind of urgent, immediate, sharp controversy get handled?
So I think the governor had left before we were aware there was a situation from that particular thing, because the reporter had been removed from the room and then the arrest happened at a different place out of the view of the governor. So the governor had just aware that something was happening, and then he had been briefed on what had happened. And of course, the interview requests had started coming in. He decided to do an interview with the network whose reporter was affected. And so, of course, we'd brief him on the situation with the media, just like if there was any incident like a tornado, the train derailment itself, he'd get an incident briefing on something like that. Certainly, I think that's the only time where he's had to have an incident briefing on a press issue with the press like that. He understands that, you know, people expect, you know, if it involves the governor at that high level, that people want to hear from him. And so he decided to do an interview with that outlet. I think he gave a few others, particularly, he does AM radio often. So Bill Cunningham down in Cincinnati, Dan Rivers in Youngstown, the folks up at WTAM in Cleveland, both Bill Wills and Bloom Daddy, used to be the late, great Mike Trevisano up there. So people from all across the state, he'd do these interviews with Scott Sands from Toledo. He'd be upset if I did not mention his name, but all these iHeartRadio talk show hosts who have the local shows in their different markets, he does those quite frequently. And certainly they wanted to ask him about what was going on with that and that particular incident as well.
You've talked a lot about some of the good parts about your job and your helping the state of Ohio, the people of the state of Ohio, be informed. What's the hardest part of your job?
I would think the hardest part is sometimes the intensity of going, you know, from these issues nonstop. There are certainly days where, you know, when we get to come home at the end of the day, you're just tired and beat because of everything that's going on there.
So can I ask you this, and I think a lot of public officials and maybe press secretaries would want to know the secret to this. You're tired, you're beat, you get one more phone call and it's 9 o'clock at night after a long night. You know you should take the call because you see it's from a reporter that you have a relationship with. How do you make sure that you say the right thing? It'd be so easy to slip and say something that you shouldn't have said or that didn't represent the governor's views or views accurately. How do you make sure that you say what needs to be said in the way that it needs to be said?
So forethought and planning are key with everything is just, you know, mapping out in your head what you would say if something comes up. Of course, a lot of these calls, you don't have the opportunity to do that. So saying, let me get the information, get back to you is a great tool that we use. I've had some others in my career. I remember being at the Attorney General's office and I got a lot more late night calls at the Attorney General's office than at the governor's office. And the reason was, is that my cell phone, and it's the same at the governor's office, it's the after hours number. If you need something immediate, you call that number. Except at the Attorney General's office, the Attorney General also ran the Bureau of Criminal Investigation, which is kind of like the FBI crime lab of the state of Ohio. Anytime there's an overnight shooting, especially one involving police officers, BCI would be called in to conduct the investigation, do the crime scene, because it's very common practice that if your police agency is involved in a shooting, you need another agency to do that investigation. It would be an appearance of impropriety if you did it yourself, even if you could do it yourself. So BCI got called in all the time, and my phone would ring at 2 a.m., 3 a.m. with, you know, hey, there was a shooting in this particular suburb. Can you let us know what's going on? And they would soon quickly tell if they woke me up from a dead sleep quickly now that I probably did not have the information and would get back to them. And in fact, I got to the point where I'd often say that, respectfully, you've woken me up from a sleep. I will have to find out what's going on because you've given me more information than I had a few minutes ago. And then I'd talk to the incident commander on command and figure out what we could tell them, which was often, we have an ongoing investigation and there's not much more I can tell you at that time. Especially because in those cases, and this is just an interesting bifurcation of things, law enforcement very rarely can be the entity that identifies decedents, people who die in shootings. It's the coroner's office. And so often when you have a press conference, the coroner is authorized, a sheriff, or in some cases an attorney general to provide the information. But the often when we were doing an investigation, I'd have to refer people to the Cuyahoga County Coroner, the Franklin County Coroner, to answer those questions. Even, you know, if we had the information, it was not our place to say it. And of course, they have an important job to do, but to identify, you know, people who died and why they died, and so we don't want to interfere with that. And so that'd be one that we'd often have to do, because that's what people want when they're trying to do breaking news from the scene of a shooting, is who died, how they died. And as an investigative agency, we couldn't provide that until weeks or months later, because our job was to find out the facts and do a thorough job and not rush to judgment. So especially because if there was a crime committed, somebody's got to prosecute that crime, and you don't want to put out incorrect information to spoil a jury or improperly influence a jury. And so we had to be very cautious working for a law enforcement agency like that and what we said, because we did not want the executive branch unduly influencing the judicial process and creating mistrials or hung juries or letting people who should be convicted off the hook because they couldn't get a fair trial that they are entitled to under the Constitution. So it was actually a very real situation where what we said as press people could, if we did the wrong thing, we could influence a case in a way that could let somebody who might have killed somebody get off scot-free. So we were very careful, and we learned some rules to talk with the press to let them know what we could say and could not say. And one of the tools we also learned is that they're just looking, again, for something they can tell the people that was more than what they had before they watched the broadcast or read the article. And so we try to gather things that we could say. Often we do things like, hey, this investigation so far has collected this many pieces of evidence. We have this many crime scenes. We have this many agents out doing it. We have our fingerprint team. We've got our DNA collection team out there. Little things like that, without giving the other pieces of information that could influence a trial, but still giving the press information to give to the public to let them know what's going on, even though some of the juicier details that would be interesting we couldn't give them at the time. And so certainly that's why shows like Dateline NBC or Forensic Files are popular, because after the fact, you can give them all that information and do a nice little write-up on what's happened. We certainly saw that with the Pike County cases, which that was certainly one of the biggest ones we've ever had in Ohio, that and certainly one that I had to deal with. But it wasn't until years later that you could actually tell the full story of what you saw.
Fascinating. An interesting situation where your words literally could be a matter of life and death.
Thank you very much. Well, one of the more interesting ones I had was the, I remember getting a text from a friend down in Cincinnati who said, I saw your name in a CNN alert. And I think the only time my name's ever ended up as a CNN alert was when those three kidnapping victims up in Cleveland, they were held in that house of horrors up in Cleveland. The we did confirm that the child that was found with them, we did the DNA test to confirm that the child was the abductor's, the rapist's child with one of the victims. And CNN just happened, we had people calling all the time. CNN just happened to be the first to call for the information. And I got the green light from the governor and from the investigators that yes, that information is okay to provide to the media. You can go ahead and do so. CNN was the first with it to call, just because they happened to call after I had gotten the green light. And so, yeah, Dan Tierney confirmed that that was the fact in a CNN alert. So,
very good. Thank you, Dan. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.